Hold on to your butt.
Da-da-da! You were saying?
Welcome to episode 125 of the Civil War Breakfast Podcast. Tonight, I am joined by the most awesome Civil War nerd I know, Darren. I told you I was going to say that. And I am his co-host, Mary, and I'm about as good at introductions as Patrick Claiborne was at writing poetry for women, which I'm sure we'll talk about in this episode.
Okay, well, that's came out of nowhere. How's it going? How's it going on? How's our post St. Patty's Day Mary doing today?
Good. It's good to be back recording again. And like I said, we are doing the Confederate half of our March episode, which last episode we talked about the Union Irish Brigade. And this week we are talking about a Confederate subject, General Patrick R. Claiborne, which we have been wanting to talk about for quite a while. We've mentioned him in quite a few episodes, but we're finally down to talking about his life. So this might be a longer episode, but that's all right. So, but before we get to that, what are you drinking?
I'm not going to lie to you. I'm pretty sure you forgot on that one, Mary. I am drinking, it's called, it's called Bird of Prey by Vanish Valley. I'm drinking that because my boss called a hockey team won tonight and they're on their way to yet another championship. And I'm drinking it out of my Chickamauga coffee mug because although Chickamauga is a small part of the episode we're going to talk about today, it is an important part nonetheless. Mm-hmm. That being said, Mary, what are you drinking on this fine Friday evening?
I am drinking She Makes Waves, which is a collaboration brew that Untold Brewing did with another local brewery. I'm not sure which one. I just know it's a collaboration. And I'm drinking it out of my Civil War Breakfast Club mug, which was the very first mug we came up with. And it's got Alexis and David Rose on it from Schitt's Creek. And Alexis has a Kepi hat on it. So that was the first mug that you came up with for our podcast. So I'm using that tonight.
Very good.
Yeah, very good. And it's usually old school.
Did. And the more you drink, I'm sure the better it'll get. But anyway, Mary, we're going to talk about this episode today. And as we've mentioned before, St. Patrick's Day is a fuzzy thing of the past for both of us, but our Irish eyes are still smiling. And we are focused again on their impact on the American Civil War. Now, you know, this time we're going to go deep behind Confederate lines to talk about a different kind of Irish soldier. That would be the rebel general, one Patrick Ronayne Claiborne. And we're going to talk a lot about this. And like you said, you've been wanting to talk to him for a while. And Patrick Claiborne, you know, he's one of those Civil War generals that certainly has a romanticism about him. Mm-hmm. You know, basically from his childhood to some academic misfortune he had that led him to join the military and ultimately his days with the Confederate Army, you know, his reputation is going to get stronger and stronger and stronger. And then he will ultimately earn the nickname the Stonewall of the West.
Yep. And he's very much, you know, in doing this episode and researching it, I mean, I've really enjoyed studying Claiborne for quite a while, but I felt I got to get him to know the person who Claiborne was a little bit better. You know, I discovered that he's very much an introvert. He was that, you know, guy that was always really, really quiet, didn't really talk a lot. You know, I don't think he liked to be the center of attention. But he was a great soldier, an amazing commander. But just the thing I came away from is he was like this quiet, quiet guy that, you know, you wouldn't, just very, I don't know, not an extrovert, not like his best friend, William J. Hardy.
No, but the thing about him is, you know, as much as he's kind of romantic in a way, he's also somewhat polarizing too. Mm-hmm. You know, many do feel that he's, you know, for every person who says he's a very underrated general in the American Civil War, there are definitely those who feel that his career was over embellished and kind of takes away from the efforts of other men who probably equally deserve it. But regardless, at the end of the day, the life of Patrick Claiborne is one that absolutely deserves a deep dive and one that is really worthy, you know, of study. So who was this guy, Mary?
So he is born on March 16th, 1828, at a place called Bride Park. That was what his father and mother called the home, which is 9 miles from Cork in Ireland. So he's from County Cork. He's the third child of Joseph and Mary Ann Claiborne. Her maiden name was Ronayne, and that's where his middle name comes from. And that's what he is called when he's growing up. He's not called Patrick. He's called by his middle name when he's growing up. And that was something I discovered in doing this research. Apparently it's more well known than, you know, Like when I went to tell you about it, you were like, oh yeah, I knew that kind of thing. But the interesting thing about Claiborne's family is that they are not Irish Catholics. They are Irish Protestants.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit here in a second, because I think it's important to understand that. You know, we did the episode last time about the Irish Brigade, guys like Michael Corcoran and Thomas Marr and those guys. And this Claiborne's different. He's not the poor Irish Catholic farmer who came across. We're going to talk about that. You know, and you mentioned before, you know, he's born on March 16th. And there's some debate. Some people will write down he's born on March 17th.
His mom
by happenstance, that's St. Patrick's
Day. His mom wrote in the family Bible it was the 16th, and he's like, he's born into, I don't know if I want to say privilege, but he's not poor. Like
he's born into privilege.
He is. Like he's a his father's a Protestant. His father's a Whig. He's a professional. He's a doctor. They have money. His dad had went to Trinity College in Dublin. He'd moved to County Cork in 1822, where he met Marianne, Claiborne's mother. And she is described as a woman of strong, independent character, a radical in politics, a defender of the oppressed, and a friend to liberty and equality. So she's a very strong woman. And as we'll see, unfortunately, Patrick, or Ronayne, as he's called when he lives in Ireland, does not get to know his mother very well at all.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. Now, you mentioned before, you know, the privilege. He was born into privilege. His father, Joseph, was a successful doctor, and he was a member of that Protestant Anglo-Irish upper class, and he was a landowner in Tipperary County. I mean, he was. And you know, so to understand Patrick's early years, and I'm going to call him Patrick because I'm just kind of confused if I call him Ronayne, it's important to understand that social structure in Ireland at the time. A lot of people don't really study. You know, despite the Irish stereotypes, you know, not everybody from Ireland was a perma-drunk Catholic farmer with red hair and anger issues, Maury. Those are more Canadians than Irish, okay? But during the 1800s, you know, there were really three distinct cultures, you know, in Ireland. You know, first there was that traditional poor Catholic, you know, farmer class who suffered badly during the Great Potato Famine of the 1840s and early 1850s, which led, of course, to that migration into the United States, right? Next were a group called the Uber Scots. Now, these are Irish who emigrated from Scotland, and they represented a large population of Ireland's lower middle class, that worker class. Mm-hmm. That's who these people were. Last were the Anglo-Irish. Now, these are descendants, like you said, of Protestant aristocrat ascendancy, and many of whom consider themselves to be more British than Irish. Yeah. You know, Arthur Wellesley, I'm sure you know who he is, Mary. He's the first Duke of Wellington. You know, many associate him with being British, but he's actually born in Dublin. Yeah. Bram Stoker, Dracula fame. He was Anglo-Irish. People think of him as British. He was born in Ireland as well. Mm-hmm. Now, this Anglo-Irish were the privileged class of Ireland, and was within this privileged class that the Claiborne family was part of. You know, as a matter of fact, Patrick's great-great-grandfather was William Claiborne, who was the Lord of St. John Manor in County Wexford in the late 1600s. So there's some history to these people. Yeah. The Claibornes were, quotation fingers, Irish, but they considered themselves Anglo-Irish. And it's an important distinction, you know, compared to those many Irish soldiers that we talked about last week and who will later continue to fight in this American Civil War. Now, you mentioned a little bit of his childhood, October 18th, 1829. You know, Patrick was about a year and a half old, 18 months or so. His mother, Mary, is going to die after giving birth to his younger brother, Joseph, Joseph Jr., leaving his father, Joseph, as a widower, right? And he's going to find love pretty quick. He's going to remarry.
Well, that was the way it was back then. You had to.
Right, it was. But this time, it's going to be to a Protestant Scot named Isabella Stewart, who will basically, in essence, be kind of Patrick's mother, and she will be a huge impact on his life growing up.
Yeah, she basically becomes his mother, and he's only, you know, he's just over 2 years old when when she comes into his life, and he's going to refer to her as mama for the rest of his life, and he even asks for her advice into adulthood. And Patrick's father, Joseph, and Isabella are going to have four children together. They're going to have Isabella, who was born in 1832, Edward, who was born in 1833, Robert in 1837, and Christopher, who is called Kit, in 1841. And Kit is going to come back into this episode closer to the end as well.
He will. The Claiborne family, they're very well-to-do, and they lived in a 200-acre estate called the Grange Farm, where Joseph had a private medical practice, as well as he was a staff doctor at the local hospital. Now, since they had money, Patrick benefited from getting an excellent education, and he had his own private tutor.
Yep.
And then when he reached age 12, he's going to enroll at a private school called the Church of Ireland Reverend William Spedding Boarding School. Sounds like a fun place to be.
Yeah, I don't think this is where very fun.
I don't think so either. And this is where he's going to be in his teens. Now, here's the thing. As a student, Patrick did okay. He loved classes like history, mathematics, your favorite, right?
Yeah.
But he hated studying foreign languages, especially Latin and especially Greek. And we're going to talk about how that's going to come back and bite you in the butt eventually, right? But in 1843, Patrick's life is going to hit a significant bump. And this is when his father is going to be treating one of his patients. He's going to catch typhus from him, and he's going to die, right? Patrick is about 15 years old at this point, and this is when he's going to make that decision, to leave school and follow his father's footsteps in medicine. And he will become an apprentice at a local apothecary.
Yeah, and it also made Patrick very emotionally distant at times from people. Like, the death of his father had a huge impact on him. Like, prior to this, growing up, one of his cousins said that, as a kid, Claiborne was full of mischief and fun, somewhat shy and dreamy with strangers, but at times he could be really domineering. After his father passed away when he was 15, Claiborne became he starts to become really, really introverted. And that part of his personality and this kind of like how he's, I guess, emotionally withdrawn carries into the American Civil War, as we're going to see as well. But he tries to do this medical apprenticeship, but because he doesn't have the languages, it really is a struggle for him.
Yeah, he's going to basically be an intern for a couple of years, and he's going to really use that internship to prepare to be admitted to medical school. 1846, he's going to apply to Apothecary Hall, which is part of the Trinity Medical School in Dublin, now the University of Dublin. But he's going to get rejected, Mary. He's going to get the old turn down. And he's going to be denied because he doesn't know how to read Latin nor Greek, which he hated in prep school. See, again, kids, listen to your high school teachers. They know what they're talking about.
Take Latin and Greek.
Okay? but he didn't like it. He didn't study it. And so when he went for his exam, he flunked out. Now, this is going to be a major traumatic event for him. And considering he's the son of the Dr. Joseph Claiborne, the aristocratic doctor, he was embarrassed, and he actually felt that this brought shame upon the entire family. So 1846, Claiborne is going to have a choice to make. He could accept a job offer at the Dublin DQ, which they offered him a position, or he could enlist in the military. And of course, he's going to choose to join the British Army. Again, we're not talking about the Irish, we're talking about the British Army here. He was hoping to be part of the British Army and get sent to India. But instead, he was assigned to join the 41st Regiment of Foot and was sent to Mullingar, Ireland, because of that growing potato famine we talked about. They kept him local. But here's the thing, Mary. Being a part of the prestigious Claiborne family and that Anglo-Irish descendancy, Patrick could have obtained an officer's commission in the army. But you know what he did? He hid his family lineage and he signed as a private. So he went to basically becoming a grunt when he kind of didn't have to.
He wanted to remain anonymous. He also lied about his age to get into the British Army, which is something too. I mean, it wasn't that bad. He was about to turn 18, but he was 17 when he was enlisted. As you said, he lies about his profession, says he was a laborer. And the regiment's motto was death before shame. So that's interesting as well, that he's enlisting in a regiment that has that. And they were actually, they were also known as the Welsh Regiment, too. Mm-hmm. And as you said, they're supposed to go to India to fight in the first Sikh War, and they don't. And like I said, he just wants to be anonymous at this point, doesn't want to flout what he has, anything like that.
Yeah, so he's in this army, and while he's in the British Army, he really, he took to soldiering very, very well, and he loved the discipline he received. And he really, he you know, as well as he really took a shine to that British model of how to drill effectively. He was paying attention. He was basically the model soldier in his life with that 41st Regiment of Foot, clearly built that foundation of what is going to show later on in his soldier life.
Yeah, you can really see how, you know, being in the British Army is shaping him for what he's going to be like in the Civil War.
Yeah. And it was, like we said, it was during this time in the British Army when that great potato famine was really striking at its hardest. And it began that mass exodus from the country. Now, you know, millions of poor Irish died or either left for America. And even though, like we said, Claiborne was not a member of the poor Irish, the farmer class, he wasn't directly a part of it. The famine still hit his family hard, and they suffered substantial financial ruin. I mean, it did. And it got to the point that, you know, despite really enjoying his new life in the army, you know, Patrick Claiborne knew that for the betterment of his family, you know, it was time to get a step in. It was time to leave Ireland. So like so many did to leave to America. So September 22nd of 1849, Claiborne's going to use his family inheritance that he had to basically buy his way out of the British Army to get discharged for service is what he did. And he's going to scoot. He's going to go along with his older sister, Anne, and his brothers, William and Joseph. They're going to board a boat called the Bridgetown, and they're going to leave Ireland for good. And they're going to get to New Orleans 2 months later in November of 1849. But they didn't stay there too long, probably because they missed Mardi Gras.
Yep.
They had no reason to stick around. So what do, Mary? From New Orleans, they're going to get on the boat, and they're going to sail up the Mississippi River. And on Christmas Day, 1849, the Claibornes are going to arrive in the lovely town of Cincinnati, Ohio, Mary, which is going to be their new home.
Yeah, and it is the second largest city in the American West what is considered the American West at the time. And Claiborne found work as a clerk in a drugstore, and they're not there for very long before he finds out that there's two physicians in Helena, Arkansas, that need a pharmacist to manage their store. And this is going to be probably one of the more significant events in Claiborne's life, is this moving to Helena, Arkansas.
This is going to be his big social break. You know, he's going to get that opportunity to go down to Helena, Arkansas, owned by two locals, a guy named Dr. Charles Nash and Hector Grant. Mm-hmm. Now in Helena, Nash and Grant really, really enjoyed Claiborne, and they both went out of their way to not only help him get a job, but also assimilate into that social structure, you know, of the town.
Yeah.
And he's new to town. He's, you know, he's not from the United States. So he's, you know, these guys really helped him out.
Well, he describes the town as, I found a quote where Claiborne describes the town, and it reminds me of that one from Star Wars where it's like, you'll never find a more, you know, scum and villainy or whatever. He said Helena, Arkansas was the haunt of the most reckless, desperate characters in the Mississippi Valley, a place where pistol and Bowie knife decided every quarrel. So he is coming into this like, whoa, this is quite the place I'm joining. And as you said, he's, you know, he begins to be assimilated into the town, and Nash and Grant really help him out. He has room and board and gets paid $50 a month for this pharmacy. And he's very enthusiastic in his job.
Nash and Grant, they enjoyed him, but they also had a lot of fun with him. They hazed him a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's the new guy. You know, there was that story when, you know, Patrick Claiborne, being from Ireland, had never seen a watermelon of all things. And he had no idea how to eat it. So Nash and Grant told him, the only way to eat a watermelon, Patrick, is to cut it into pieces, boil it. And something that Claiborne goes, well, okay, sounds good. And that's what he did. And they all get a big laugh as they boiled the watermelon, and they ate it with spoons out of a bowl. And basically probably because he was embarrassed by the watermelon incidents, but he was cool with it. You know, Claiborne, again, continued to earn praise by his bosses. And they really appreciated his work ethic, how hard he worked.
Mm-hmm.
His work ethic was so impressed Dr. Nash that when Grant decided to sell his share of the business, he gave Claiborne a loan to help buy out Grant's share and become part owner of this pharmacy. You know, something Claiborne absolutely appreciated, and it drove him to work even harder. Claiborne became the man about town, and as they say, and he took this opportunity to feel like he belonged.
Yeah.
So he really, you know, he really became very active in the local social circles, right?
I was going to say, he also breaks away from that Irish stereotype, which he sees when he gets to America, and he sees it in Helena too. You know, there's Irish jokes in the paper everywhere. You know, whether they be about a drunken Irishman or whatever. But the one thing to mention about Claiborne is that he does drink socially at first, but very quickly stops, because Nash put it best when he said, instead of making Claiborne jovial, it made him angry and, as he said, crazy. And after one drinking bout, the last drinking bout that Claiborne ever had, Claiborne threatened to kill Nash for waking him up. And after that, he just didn't. And he also didn't want to embody that, you know, that Irish stereotype. But for somebody who's like described as, like I read one description of Claiborne where it was said his face was often like that of the Sphinx. Like you couldn't really tell what emotion he had. Like when he drank, it changed him completely. He was an angry drunk.
Well, it's probably one of the groups he joined in Helena was the Temperance Club.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's where he joined. 1852, he's going to join the Lafayette Lodge number 16 and become a Freemason. And he's going to quickly rise to a leadership position in the lodge. By 1853, Claiborne will be elected Master of the Lodge. And soon after, he will receive the prestigious Sublime Degree of Royal Archmason in a ceremony that was conferred on him by future Confederate General Albert Pike, who was an A-lister in the Freemasonry world to this day. So this is who he's becoming. He's rising in the social network to a point when he's really becoming a leader. So in less than 4 years, Claiborne has gone from quitting the British Army, heading to America, to becoming a part owner of a business and a well-respected citizen leader in Helena. And this just goes to show that the contrast between the experiences of the Irish New York City and Boston and Philly. It just really shows when you study him, you realize it's night and day. Helena, Arkansas, you know, in the South for in general, became Patrick Claiborne's true home now.
Yeah.
And not Ireland. And he continued to climb in social circles as the town grew from a small town to a much bigger city, right? So 1854, Claiborne decides to move on from that pharmacy and chase a career in law, which was always his dream, apparently. He dreamt about it while he was sleeping in Latin class, right? But that's what he wanted to do. But he became involved in local politics too. Now, you mentioned a little while ago, he was a Whig, right?
Yep.
But when that party fell apart, he joined the Democratic Party as an alternate because the Know Nothing Party that was big at the time, and we mentioned last time, they're very anti-immigrant.
Yeah.
And because of, you know, his foreign blood, he just couldn't possibly imagine signing up for something like that. So he became a Democrat. He will pass the bar in 1856, and he will form a law partnership with another young and up-and-coming hooligan in Helena named Thomas C. Hinman, talked about.
You could ask for two opposites.
Well, I mean, yes and no. They were both Democrats, and Hinman was into politics too. Hinman was running for Congress in the first Arkansas district in 1856, and Claiborne supported him, helped him out. I don't know if he knocked on doors or what he did, but he was helping Hinman. And it was around this time Claiborne's going to become a U.S. citizen too.
Yes.
And Claiborne is going to also become friends with another local named Lucius Polk, of all people. And he'll have a long Civil War history too as well. But Claiborne is going to learn the dark side of American politics around this point. You know, Hinman's going to end up losing that race. He's not going to win right away for Congress. But during the campaign, he got into a Twitter feud with a guy named, who was a Know Nothing legislator. It was a newspaper feud.
Yeah, I know.
With a guy named W.D. Rice. And maybe Hinman forgot to state his sources. We don't know. But it pissed off Rice very, very badly, right? Now, on May 24th of 1856, while they were out in town doing their thing, Claiborne and Hinman found themselves getting ambushed on the street by Hinman's rival. This guy Rice, along with three of Rice's relatives, they just jumped him.
Yeah.
And the altercation became violent when Rice and his men pulled out their guns and they just started blasting.
Yeah.
Right? They just started shooting. And Hinman and Claiborne are both going to get hit. Claiborne's going to be hit seriously.
Yeah.
He'll be shot in the lung, but Claiborne's going to fire back. So he was packing heat too.
Yeah.
And he's going to kill one of Rice's relatives. Hinman's life was, I mean, Claiborne's life was actually life threatening.
It was about 10 days that his life was kind of hanging there, because Hinman, you know, they looked at him and they're like, the bullet had passed through his right lung and then lodged near his spine. And they were like, well, we don't know if we can do surgery on him or not. So for 10 days, it was like touch and go with him. But eventually the bullet was found and removed, and Claiborne recovered, but he was never quite the same after that. And he wrote to his brother, Robert, my lungs have never been the same since I was wounded. I catch a cold on the smallest provocation, and an hour's excited debate in the courthouse will sometimes fill my mouth with blood. So he's not quite the same after this happens to him.
And the best part of that story, neither Claiborne nor Hinman get charged.
Nope, they were exonerated by a grand jury.
Get convicted. I mean, imagine shooting a politician. Different world.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, the way he describes Helena as being this kind of like, it's like the Wild West. And it was clearly like from his description, something that he had never, you know, it's like, whoa, this place is like, it's crazy.
No, talking about it. But the thing about it, this was going to be the really cementing of the friendship between Claiborne and Hinman. Mm-hmm. And it won't be long where Hinman's going to get married to Mary Watkins Biscoe in 1856. And Claiborne, of course, will be his best man. And, you know, Hinman, you know, ironically, Hinman did finally win that congressional seat a couple of years later, 1858. And he began his political career as a very pro-slavery candidate, as a congressman right from the beginning. 1859. For the most part, is when he took office. But again, it was the important election of 1860 on the horizon that where all the rumors were starting, because that's where the rumors of secession were really picking up in the South, right? So with this talk of secession and possible war in the air, Claiborne is going to use his social weight to raise a local militia. He will raise a company called the Yell Rifles, which is named after Arkansas Governor Archibald Yell. Mm-hmm. And just like he did as he learned and he experienced in the British Army, when, you know, he's going to join as a private, but quickly he'll be made a captain pretty quickly. They're going to know who he is here. So 1860, he's going to be running that company. But despite being somewhat, like you said, shy and kind of aloof to those meeting him, Claiborne was still the obvious choice, you know, to lead his company. Yeah. He was smart. He was popular. He was a high-ranking Freemason. He was the guy plugged into Helena's social scene. So he was going to get that gig, right? And he was the rare type of people who was loved by almost everyone in town, you know, both by the rich and the poor. Claiborne, like we said, by a lot of these people, he's that natural leader.
Yeah.
And someone and everyone in town just really respected. Well, that's just who he was.
And he's involved in so much in town besides, you know, the Freemasons. He's in the debating society. He forms the first chess club in Helena, Arkansas, where he's the president too. So he's kind of got that nerdy aspect to him as well. And as you said, he's part of the Temperance Society, so he's very well known. And then there's like the politics, owning the store. I mean, if you're a store owner, you're going to be well known as well. But then there's also being a lawyer. So he's come a long way. And when you contrast that with, you know, the episode we did last week, that some of these Irish are here, they're joining up in the Civil War, and they want to take back what they're going to learn in the army, take it back to Ireland. Claiborne never has any intention of going back to Ireland at all.
No, this was his home now. He was described as looking as Irish as St. Patrick O'Flynnipo, but talks without a Hibernian accent. Mm-hmm. Interesting, right? They said he stood about 5'11". His hair was originally very dark black, but as he got older, steadily turned more gray. Welcome aboard.
Yep.
But the thing about it, though, is you know he was Irish, but he was based on his Anglo-Irish upper class background. You know, who attended private schools and came from money. You know, he avoided a lot of that anti-Irish stigma. I mean, he got it a little bit, but he didn't get it as much as the Irish immigrants did, like we said, in other parts of the country. And so he, when this is all going down, he's looked to as a leader. The governor of Arkansas at the time, a guy named Henry Massey Rector, you know, they're debating about the states to decide about secession or not. And they're trying to decide. And, you know, Rector was very, very, very clear in his record of slavery. You know, he absolutely was. At the state's emergency convention held on March 2nd, 1861, Governor Rector, he said, the area of slavery must be extended. The North believes slavery is a sin. We do not, and therein lies the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cut and dry right there, right? So by the time of the firing at Fort Sumter, you know, Claiborne is a successful lawyer, a militia captain, and one who neither owned slaves nor supported slavery or had an opinion. He didn't care, right?
I mean, he doesn't have an opinion on it at all.
But after the firing of Fort Sumter, though, and Abraham Lincoln's request of 750 troops from Arkansas to put down the rebellion, Claiborne very much supported Arkansas's decision to become the ninth state to secede when they seceded from the Union on May 6th of 1861. Claiborne said of it, his quote about it was, "The North is about to wage a brutal and unholy war on people who have not done them wrong, in violation of the Constitution and the fundamental principles of government." So he's basically, he continues, "They no longer acknowledge that the government derives its validity from the consent of the governed." So he's drawn his battle lines very clearly. He doesn't care so much about slavery, but he's very much into, these guys are screwing us here, and we're going to fight for, you know, we're going to fight for a right to party. Yeah. That's kind of what he's thinking, right? So his Yell Rifles, at this point, they're going to get absorbed into the 1st Arkansas Regiment, and he'll be elected colonel of the regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sent to a place called Pittman's Ferry for garrison duty. This is in the summer of 61 along a river called the Current River. Later in October 62, Mary, there's going to be a skirmish at Pittman's Ferry. You know what they called it? The skirmish at Pittman's Ferry. How's that for creativity? Yep. Right? But anyway, the 1st Arkansas, for the most part, will be in a brigade by a guy you mentioned named William J. Hardy, right? A guy that the Arkansas men called Old Reliable.
Yep.
That was the nickname they called him, okay? And this will be the beginning of a long friendship between Patrick Claiborne and William Hardy.
Yep, and they were very much opposites. Like, you know, Hardy is often described as dressing like a dandy. He's, you know, got kind of the best clothes. And Claiborne is often said to, like, you know, once he, you know, it's going to be a little bit before he gets this, but even when he became like a major general, he still dressed like a private, you know, like you couldn't really tell. He just, and Hardy often made fun of him for that this, you know, Claiborne just didn't dress as well. And it was kind of embarrassing if Hardy ran into some women and there's Pat Claiborne on his side and he's just kind of bumbling along, you know.
Well, there's definitely stories like that. Yeah. I mean, but Hardy was a military celebrity though, before the U.S. Army.
He had
that
book, right? Hardy's Tactics.
He literally wrote the book on tactics that both armies use. And it was the best known drill manual of the Civil War. But, you know, not just Claiborne, but you know, they seemingly all the men of the regiment really admired Hardy. It wasn't just Patrick. It was all of them. He trained his men really hard. He kept his men fed well. He kept them well supplied. You know, he was a good leader. But of all the Arkansas men, you know, it was Claiborne who really appreciated the drilling that Hardy did. And this goes back to England, or back to Ireland again. And this is the thing he really enjoyed back with that 41st Regiment of Foot.
Mm-hmm.
So with Hardy's blessing and experience, Claiborne continued to drill his own regiment really, really hard as he saw fit. And quickly his regiment, that originally called the 1st Arkansas, it really became a really strong and well-trained regiment very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So by the fall of 1861, when Hardy's brigade joined Albert Sidney Johnson's Army of Central Kentucky, this is by March 4th, 1862. Hardy was so impressed with Claiborne that he promoted him to brigadier general after Hardy himself was promoted to division commander. So he's, again, just like in Helena, he's seeing his military career now really, really pick up. And this is around the time of the 1st Arkansas. Someone realized there are two 1st Arkansas somehow.
Yeah, so they become the 15th.
They become the 15th. I don't know how the hell that happens, but I don't know if they drew straws or what the hell they did. But
probably like Claiborne's me, unable to do math and count.
Well, probably. Claiborne's old regiment is now the 15th Arkansas, so you'll start to see that. And Claiborne's going to continue to drill his men hard. Now he's got a full brigade, and he's going to see his first action when his men raided South Central Kentucky, where he freaked out the commander of that area, Mary, a guy named William T. Sherman, who was going to – he was going to end up being the bane of Sherman's existence off and on throughout the war here. Claiborne was aggressive, and it was noticed by just about everybody how he was. You know, by then, Forts Henry and Donelson had fallen to U.S. Grants. Claiborne finds himself in Corinth, Mississippi, with the 2nd Brigade, which included the 15th Arkansas, his old regiment, the 6th Mississippi, the 2nd, 23rd, and 24th Tennessee, and the 35th Tennessee, the 5th Provisional, including the Helena Artillery. Mm-hmm. So this is who his men are at the time. The brigade, ironically, the guy who ran the 1st Brigade right next door was, guess who? Thomas Inman.
Yeah.
So he's right there by his side as well. And we're not going to spend too much time about how these battles go, but when March turned to April, Claiborne's left wing marched north towards Pittsburgh Landing, Tennessee, and soon they were preparing to launch an attack on Union forces on April 6th of 1862. And the thing is, you know, early in the morning, Claiborne's brigade, with they're on the left, and they're part of that first wave, and they're going to run into the Union 5th Division, again under the command of Sherman.
Yep.
Near Shiloh Church.
Yep. And this is going to be the Battle of Shiloh. Right. And we did, I think, a couple episodes on Shiloh.
Yeah. We're not going to spend too much time, because this will go all night with it, like Lionel Richie all night long. We start talking about Shiloh in detail. But I mean, the thing about it is again, Claiborne's men, they're vicious, they're relentless. And they're going to lead the attack and really successfully push Sherman's men eventually back towards Pittsburgh mm-hmm. Landing. And again, by nightfall, the Union Army under Grant is pushed right back to the Tennessee River. In the Battle of Shiloh, it looks like a complete Confederate victory until Don Carlos Buell's Army of Ohio was going to arrive.
Beauregard tells Jeff Davis, hey, yeah. I think we got ourselves a victory here.
Yeah. Buell's guys arrive, and it ends up being a lot different. The next day, the 7th, while the Union men are driving, because they're counterattacking now, Claiborne and his men are again in the lead. This time they're flying, they're commanding the rebel, rebel counterattacks, and they'll be flying that unique blue flag, right?
Yep.
The blue flag with the white circle, which will be known as Hardee's flag.
The one behind me right now.
Right. And that flag is going to become synonymous with vicious fighting as the war goes on. And, you know, everyone knows the story of how Shiloh ends, but Claiborne's brigade has 1,000 losses.
Yeah. It's not
out of 2,700 men, 37% casualties, which is going to represent the highest casualty percentage in any Confederate brigade at the Battle of Shiloh. So, again, this is their really baptism by fire for a lot of these guys. And they're right up front on both days, and they get whacked, but they keep fighting.
Yeah, it's definitely not his greatest day in the Civil War, but as we're going to see, he does learn from it. After the battle, General Hardee will say of him, Brigadier General Claiborne conducted his command with persevering valor. No repulse discouraged him, but after many bloody struggles, he assembled the remnant of his brigade and was conspicuous for his gallantry to the end of the battle. And he, you know, like I said, it's not his best day, but he is going to learn from this and improve upon it. And that becomes evident as the battles go on and on.
He's going to double down when the army goes to Corinth, Mississippi. Yeah. And for the most part, when the Union army is advancing, which is going to result in the first battle of Corinth, that's going to end on May 30th of 1862, you know, he's going to help basically be the speed bump to help the army escape and be that caboose that's going to keep the Union away, which is going to be kind of foreshadowing of some things that are going to come later on with him. So really, you know, By this point, I mean, people of the army, who is this Claiborne guy? I mean, this guy, whatever he does.
Yeah.
By the summer of 62, Claiborne's brigade is going to get assigned to Edmund Kirby Smith's army in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And they're going to participate in those raids in southeastern Kentucky. But in this situation, this is August 29th of 1862, Claiborne's going to be put in temporary division command now.
Yeah.
And when he's going to command a large provisional division, brigades of Preston Smith and Benjamin Hill at the Battle of Richmond, right?
Yeah.
And again, here, Claiborne is going to act aggressively. He's going to lead his men to Kool-Aid the man through the Union line. They're going to burst right through the roast of the Union Army. And when it's over, Claiborne has his fingerprints all over the most lopsided Confederate victory of the war, as Bull Nelson's Union Army lost 5,300 men to Kirby Smith's 400. A full metal pantsing.
Yeah.
And Claiborne was a big part of that.
Yeah, except he's not there to see the end part of it, because at one point he goes over to his Lucius Polk gets wounded, and he goes over to him because they're very good friends, make sure he's okay. And as Claiborne is opening his mouth to say, oh, I'm glad you're okay, or something to that effect, A mini ball pierces his left cheek, smashes two of his teeth on his bottom jaw, and just exits his mouth. And Claiborne will later joke that he caught the ball in his mouth and spat it out. So he ends up getting wounded. He tries to stay on the field for a while, but his mouth starts swelling up. It gets filled with blood. And finally, someone is like, dude, like you need to go to the rear. You need to be stitched up. You can't be here. So he's unable to see what he's done at Richmond, but it doesn't go unnoticed. One thing that I do want to mention that Claiborne does with his men before Richmond and just after Shiloh, and this does help contribute, this helps with what happened at Richmond, is that he recognizes that warfare has definitely changed from that Napoleonic style tactic. What he saw at Shiloh was basically like, you're bushwhacking, you're not doing Napoleonic style warfare. And he realizes that if he had sharpshooters, it would be a lot more effective, and could turn the outcome in the battle to his advantage. So he discusses this idea with his officers, and he explains to the rank and file what he's going to do. And the best 5 shots from each company would be detached to form a special company of sharpshooters. And they would be deployed in advance of the brigade as skirmishers. They're going to be used to outflank the enemy, or to shoot down enemy gunners who are working on artillery pieces. And he explained these reasons even to the rank and file soldiers so that they would understand. And again, this goes back to how good of a leader Claiborne is he's wanting them to understand, this is why I'm having you do this. But the other thing too is these shooting contests, you know, in that kind of lull between Corinth and Richmond, it gives them something to do. It's an activity, you know, they can have competitions. It helps to improve their morale. So he has these sharpshooters with him now going into the Battle of Richmond. And like I said, he's unable to see the end of what he does because he gets wounded. But Richmond shows how much Claiborne had matured in those few months since Shiloh. And it's a victory. As you said, it's one of the most lopsided ones for the Confederates. And Claiborne is a huge reason for that.
It was, but he got shoved, like, breaks 5 teeth, that goes through his mouth, and he's going to have to rehab for a month, but he's going to rejoin his command on September 21st, but again, back as a brigade commander. That division thing was just temporary, that whole thing got you know, it was provisional, got dissolved. But like you said, while the army was gone, the army is going to consolidate with General Braxton Bragg's Army of Tennessee back in Lexington, Kentucky, you know, before being driven out again by Don Carlos Buell's army. Okay, but October 8th, you know, Bragg is going to reform and he'll attack Buell. It will be known as the Battle of Perryville. But Claiborne's already back at this point leading his brigade. Yep. And I'm not going to lie to you, Mary. If I got shot in the face at work, I'm milking that. I'm taking time.
He's like, I'm coming back.
I mean, it's a month, right? At Perryville, Claiborne is again going to be aggressive. He'll be wounded 2 more times. And it'll be a really strong performance by Bragg, actually, outnumbered 3-1. But he's going to successfully push Buell back before exiting Kentucky altogether back to Knoxville, Tennessee. Yep. In the end, we did an episode on this. In the end, Bragg is going to give up Kentucky for whatever reason. And is that key border state we talk about. And the Confederacy will never get it back again. And many view Perryville, this guy included, as one of the big turning points of the war, Mary, if you really think about it.
When you study Perryville, it really is.
It's very underrated, you know, but despite being wounded again, you know, Claiborne is going to continue to play a very important role in Bragg's retreat from Perryville to Knoxville. And this is the story where they're retreating. It's rainy, it's muddy, it's crappy, and all the roads are very difficult to get by. Claiborne's wounded again, and he's riding in the back of the ambulance, which is where the supply trains were. Now, they all knew how critical, important these supply wagons were, and under no circumstances could they be lost. And again, due to the weather, the roads, to the proximity of a much larger Union army, they were very, very vulnerable. But despite being injured, you know, Claiborne's going to take command on his own initiative to make sure these supply trains get through safely. And it's not going to be the only time he does that, but he's going to save Bragg's trains for the most part. And so by the time that Bragg's army is going to regroup again near Murfreesboro, Tennessee, Claiborne's reputation of an all-around solid commander has reached the Confederate White House in Richmond. So what happens? December 13th, President Jefferson Davis, Mary, is going to personally promote Patrick Claiborne to major general. And Claiborne's going to get his own division again, but this time on a permanent basis. Now, the thing about it, his division is going to be in William Hardee's Second Corps, the Army of Tennessee, and it's going to include his former brigade, which is now commanded by Helena Friend Lucius Polk, as well as brigades under St. John R. Liddell, Bushrod Johnson, and the great Sterling A.M. Wood, Mary, a man known to rise to every early situation, right?
So Johnson and Wood are in the same.
Johnson and Wood, okay, first, you know. But the thing about the whether he knew it or not, at that very moment, Patrick Claiborne was now the highest ranking Irish-born general in American military history at that very moment. And this is the situation now going into the end of 1862. Right now, we're not going to spend more time talking about the battles and this and that. But the Army of the Cumberland, with 43,000 men, is led by his new commander William Rosecrans, who is in the process of advancing from Nashville towards Bragg's position along the Stones River near Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And again, we're not going to go into too many details of the battle, but seeing Rosecrans' men set to attack on the morning of 12/31. Bragg, despite only having 35,000 men, decides he's going to attack first. Now, Claiborne, yet again, is going to be put in front in his orders, and he orders his new division now to forward, and they'll hit the Union right flank against Jefferson C. Davis's division, and it's going to drive them back all the way en route to the Nashville Turnpike. Now, he'll pursue these running Federals. But for some reason, who knows, the effort was slow this time, was disjointed. It just didn't work out. He'll run into the 3rd Division under fun-loving Phil Sheridan, Mary.
Oh, my favorite. As well as
Louis Rousseau's 1st Division in an area called the Slaughter Pen, which is a natural defensive area of trees and rocks, etc. But Claiborne, once again, is going to get the feds to fall back. And he has enough steam for maybe one more push, right? And if he sees the Nashville Turnpike, it's the Union supply line back to Nashville. And he's just about there. He's almost there when fresh Federal troops arrive. And Claiborne, again, after losing 33% of his men again, they're going to have to fall back themselves, right? Yeah. And we did a whole episode on this, but Stones River was an absolute bloodbath. And Bragg's whole army had to fall back to their winter encampment to rest and recover from a brutal 1862 near War Trace, Tennessee, right? Now, Claiborne already had the reputation of being one of the most aggressive and smartest generals in the Army of Tennessee. But after Stones River, he knew they needed to get better.
Yeah.
He really did, right? And they did. You mentioned before the sharpshooter situation. Yep. That was improving. They were able to get English Whitworth rifles at this point and help that whole wing of it. And also to promote divisional pride, they kind of stole that blue and white flag and made it their own.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why you see the Hardy flag ends up being called the Claiborne flag a lot. And it's at this moment when Claiborne says, "That flag, I want that. That's ours."
Yep.
And he takes it.
That's why it becomes known as the flag of Claiborne's division. And the other thing, too, with Claiborne becoming a division commander is he has more staff. So this is when you have Captain Irving Buck, who you will hear quite a bit in the history of Patrick Claiborne. If you study him, you're going to hear the name Irving Buck. So Buck writes of Claiborne that he is quiet, has little to say, and anyone to see and not know him would take him much sooner for a private than a major general. So again, it goes back to Claiborne's quiet nature, but Claiborne also has a kind of, I don't know, just another side to him, which is kind of fun. Apparently, he had at this time a pet raccoon at his headquarters, and it's St. John Liddell who writes about this raccoon, that at night the raccoon would try to find someone to share a bed with to keep warm. Sometimes it would get kicked out, but usually someone would take pity on the poor creature and be like, "Okay, you can share my bed tonight." But Liddell said there was one night everybody seemed unfriendly to him and kept kicking him out. And after trying all the beds, the poor fellow stopped and set up a most pitiable cry. And then someone ended up taking him in for the night. So that is just one of these stories from Pat Claiborne, about Pat Claiborne, that kind of shows this other side that, the division commander has a pet raccoon.
Yeah. I mean, the camp stories with Claiborne are probably the best stories because we talk about battles and leading the left, all this, but it's the stories, and St. John Liddell, he's one of, it's around this time, all these stories are coming out while they're in this camp in the early winter of 63, you know, where Claiborne really helps strengthen that that odd couple relationship with William Hardy.
Yep.
You know, Saint-Jean-Art Liddell, you know, he you know, he's one of Claiborne's brigade guys. He tells that story of the time when he went to visit Claiborne, who had ridden off with Hardy and had to wait for him back in camp.
Mm-hmm.
In Liddell, he says, when Claiborne came riding back, he was alone. And according to Liddell, in a not tidy appearance, like you said, he dressed like a whatever,
yep.
like a bag,
probably
right?
Dressed like I did in grade 9, plaid and jeans.
Oh yeah, probably. Absolutely. I've seen those pictures. But he also said Claiborne appeared to be pissed off at something. And you heard him say it was about Hardy being late and running after women. And when Liddell and Claiborne were talking, Hardy arrives and he yells as loud as anybody could hear, "Have you seen anything of my wild Irish general?"
Yeah.
He's young, looking for Claiborne, right? Claiborne is pretending to ignore him and he's just staring into space trying to fight a smile, like he can't hear him.
Yeah.
And everyone's looking at Claiborne, he's like, right? And so the surgeon of the division, a guy named Dr. Johnson, he yells to Hardy, "Oh yeah, General, he's right over here. Come down, he's right here," right? And Claiborne, of course, is embarrassed when Hardy comes over to him and says to General Claiborne, "Is it not proper for a subordinate officer invited to ride with a commander to come properly dressed?" And Claiborne says, yes, sir, right? And then Hardy continues an earshot of the others. Now, here is Claiborne coming out so badly dressed as to be frightened home at the sight of ladies who happened to meet him on the road. And Claiborne awkwardly responds that he was not prepared to meet the ladies. Dr. Hardy and Dr. Johnson and Hardy, they go back and forth laughing about Claiborne being embarrassed. And basically it brought Claiborne, you know, trying to fight back laughter at this point. And what it does, it shows Claiborne's personality, where he was brutal in battle, but he was bashful and sometimes standoffish to those who don't really know him.
Yeah.
And he had some very peculiar habits. You mentioned the pet raccoon thing, right? And is that story where the raccoon runs up the tree afterwards and
yep.
someone says, "Oh, the Yankees probably treat him better anyway. Let's leave him alone."
They just leave the poor raccoon.
You know, but he had a poor raccoon. But both Rosecrans and Bragg, you know, they stayed in their camps for the first half of 1863 until the Union began that fantastic Tullahoma campaign we talked about, which basically drove Bragg's army all the way back towards Chattanooga with barely a shot fired. And this is going to be get that cat and mouse game between Bragg and Rosecrans. Now, in September of 1863, when Rosecrans's army was divided, you know, Bragg, who has higher numbers now, because especially he has the arrival of one James Longstreet now from the Army of Northern Virginia, they're going to attack Rosecrans. And September 19th, it'll be basically the second day of what will be the Battle of Chickamauga. Looking at you, Minty and Wilder. People say it's the first day, but it's the second day, right?
It's on September 18th.
And we're not going to talk about the Battle of Chickamauga again. But again, you know, he's going to launch that attack around dusk. And with daylight disappearing, this is Claiborne now.
Mm-hmm.
His men kind of get spread out. And they only see the flashes of the muzzles. And his men fought right up until total darkness and only stopped when his men couldn't see anymore. Possible fear of the sighting of the Rosewood's clown maybe had something to do with slowing them down before
there's some creepy shit in those woods at Chickamauga.
They stopped cold. Claiborne's action on September 20th was delayed. He was supposed to attack at dawn, but he didn't get orders till mid-morning, and by the time it was a big mess. And you know, we're not gonna, like I said, get too much into this, but at the end of the battle, the Union is going to get driven back towards Chattanooga, and then it's going to be a big victory for Bragg.
There is one story I have about Claiborne at this battle, and it's more of like a personal. It's a story of how he treated a Union. There's a lieutenant that was captured from the Union side, so it's an officer, Union officer, and he wasn't answering Claiborne's questions. Claiborne's like, "Where are your lines?" And the guy's like, "I'm not telling you anything, dude." So Claiborne's like to a staff officer, "You take charge of him. He's yours." And the staff officer asked the Union officer, "Well, do you have anything to eat?" And the lieutenant's like, "Yeah, actually, I do. I've got hardtack and I've got coffee." And the staff officer tried to claim it as his prize. The soldiers that captured the officer were like, "No, that's ours." And they're all sitting by a fire at this point. So Claiborne is hearing the argument as he's sitting by the fire, and he gets up from the fire and he walks over to listen to it. And then he finally says, like, you know, he said to the officer, like, well, it's your property. Do you want to keep it? And the officer's like, actually, yeah, I would. And Claiborne just looked at him and said, I think that's a very sensible decision you just made. And so the officer gets to keep his food, his hardtack, and his coffee. And the officer later recalled that Claiborne was very polite to him.
Yeah, Claiborne was fair. He was tough, but he was fair. No question about that. You know, in his role at Chickamauga, for the most part, you don't want to say it was nondescript, but he wasn't in the front of the line. He wasn't like a lot of these other guys.
He's not in there. He's not in there as much as like Longstreet and Hood are in there.
No.
During that breakthrough. And all that. He's very much, you know, kind of his night attack is something that Bragg almost does as an afterthought, because remember at the Battle of Chickamauga, Bragg has one plan going into it in the morning of the 18th, and Minty and Wilder, just basically what they do, they make Bragg have to go back to the drawing board and redo everything. So that's why Chickamauga is the battle that it is because of that.
It is. But, you know, following Chickamauga, you know, Bragg is going to send James Longstreet away. He's going to go to Knoxville to fight Ambrose Burnside. And speaking of which, Barry, real quick, sidebar, Colonel Ed Lowe's book is going to be discussed on April 16th, yes, about this battle in Knoxville. Yep. So pay attention to that, okay? But anyway, so Rosecrans is going to basically be set up in Chattanooga. And while Bragg's siege is bearing down on them and it seems like things are in control, Bragg will send Claiborne to Knoxville to basically assist Longstreet. But he'll get recalled pretty quickly.
Yeah, pretty much putting his troops on the train. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, he wants you to come back. And Claiborne's like, WTF.
Well, Bragg wants you. Realize U.S. Grant is there, and he's increased their numbers, and Grant's going to try to break out of Chattanooga. So he obviously wants as many guys as he can. Grant is going to ask his best subordinate, William Sherman, to take a place called Tunnel Hill, which is an extremely strategic place in the area. Now, if Sherman takes Tunnel Hill, the rebel position becomes extremely untenable. They'll be flanked. They'll be in a tough spot. Claiborne's going to arrive right in the nick of time and take position on Tunnel Hill, which will become a real cramp in Grant's junk, because for Sherman, you have to wonder at this point, like, you know, Sherman must have seen that blue and white flag in his sleep, because here we go again. He gets there and he sees Claiborne yet again in his front.
Again.
So on November 25th, of course, the greatest day in the calendar, Mary, we know that.
Yeah.
Claiborne is going to move his men on the defensive on Tunnel Hill, along with Shot Pouch Walker, and Carter Stevenson. It wasn't just Claiborne, and they're going to push. They're going to push back Sherman, and this is going to force Grant to change his plan. This is kind of the big part of the Battle of Chickamauga. Yep. I mean, Chattanooga. This is going to force Grant to have George the Rock of Mill Springs Thomas attack Missionary Ridge, mm-hmm, which will ultimately drive Bragg off the field. But Claiborne's line didn't break, and again, because Claiborne's line with Shaw Pouch and with Stevenson, they forced Grant to change his battle plan because they couldn't get through to Tunnel Hill. And this isn't an indictment of Sherman or anything like that, but it just didn't work out. There's a lot of stuff with Sherman going on at the time, and who knows. But suffice it to say, they finally do break through, and Bragg has to withdraw, which is catastrophic because Chattanooga was the gateway in the Deep South. And it really opened the door for Grant to do many things now. He could do whatever the hell he wanted, right? And, you know, at this point, Bragg, you know, he needs to save his army, but and its supplies. So again, what does he do? He turns to arguably his most valuable general at this point to buy them time. And this is where Claiborne's story really picks up a wrinkle gap, right?
Yeah.
It'll add to that legacy of Claiborne being a smart and aggressive commander. You know, Claiborne had to buy time to allow Bragg's army to escape to Dalt, Georgia. And in Ringgold, Georgia, is where the Western and Atlantic Railroad runs between these two peaks, Taylor Ridge and the White Oak Mountain, right? And he's going to post guns on the ridge and where this bottleneck exists. And he's going to have much fewer men. Only 4,000 guys is all he has. But the ground is fantastic. It's a great place to put artillery. His nemesis this time will be fighting Joe Hooker, Mary, who will take 16,000 men to try to chase Bragg, right? So right off the bat, 4-1 odds. But Hooker is Hooker, and he screws the whole thing up. He attacks piecemeal and the whole thing. But for 5 full hours, Claiborne is going to hold Hooker off, including that ferocious fight against David Ireland's 137 yep. New York, right? Right outside of Ringgold Station. Eventually, Hooker is going to have to fall back to Chattanooga, and Claiborne has bought up time for Bragg's Army of Tennessee to fight another day. So if you're keeping track, Mary, Claiborne has now had success against Sherman 2 times,
yep.
and now Hooker. So he's fighting some pretty big generals at this point.
Yeah.
You know, that's who he is. And what this did allow, it allowed the Confederates to get rest into winter camp in Dalton. And this is where those new promotions were to be had, if he had new men to train. And so he gets another chance now to train guys and kind of deal with a whole new group.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's going to have his guys at this time are going to be Lowry, Granberry, and Lucius Polk is still with him, and Govan.
Right, but Ours more important, psychologically, Claiborne's on a heater now.
Oh yeah,
this is peak Claiborne success politically right now. He's got it right. He saved the army again, and now you know his divisions have camped at a place called Tunnel Hill, Georgia. Different Tunnel Hill. Now he's Tunnel yep. Hill, Georgia, right? And they're going to spend those months drilling. But there's an issue though, Mary, in that many of his men, their 3-year enlistment papers mm-hmm. are running up now. So it's hard to sell these men, you know, many who are missing their families. They're hearing rumors of the Union troops burning farms in their state. That, you know, they don't want to be there. But Claiborne's going to basically remind his men patriotism and the Southern independence is the goal, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to work because a lot of his men reenlisted. Now, admittedly, you know, the Confederates put the Conscription Act in later and those three,
yep.
they would have had to come back anyway, but they would have stayed. They would not have gone home and forced to come back. They stayed. And so that's a big deal for them. But the thing about it though, this is where it gets important with this, they're running out of men. And to him, the war is a mathematical equation. And eventually the North superiority in manpower is ultimately going to win out. It's just going to. And the thought of trying to even the numbers is in his head. Bragg's army is still kicking, like the other Confederate armies in the East are. But they're kind of running out of manpower. They're kind of running on borrowed time. They needed men to fill the ranks, and Claiborne felt that was really their only chance.
Yeah.
If the true goal is Southern independence, they needed to do whatever it took to achieve this goal. He knew the men needed – that the South needed men more than Bruce Dickinson needed more cowbell at this point. Very, very. This was a desperate, desperate situation, right? Because they knew U.S. Grant was going to eventually win this war through attrition, which mm-hmm. he eventually did.
Yeah.
But they knew it was coming. So while in this winter camp, the men rested, and even their camp songs talked about this. In a song called "Annie Darling," it's a great song right here. The lyrics are sung. Come, come, rain to the top of my boots. Oh, come, and I think ye to keep back the Yankee units until our ranks are filled with recruits. So all their songs are about, we need more dudes.
Yep.
Even the songs are about that. Now, this isn't exactly Elton John, but it tells a story of what the situation was at the time. Yep. And it was here, sitting down thinking about the issue, Claiborne is going to make his greatest political miscalculation. And he's going to touch that third rail of Southern politics, which arguably stalled his career going forward. And what was that idea?
He comes up on January 2nd, 1863. He has a meeting. Joseph E. Johnson is there. Hardy is there. William Bate, Patton Anderson, W.H.T. Shotpouch Walker, just to name a few, are there. And this is, it's called Claiborne's Proposal. It's also called Claiborne's Emancipation. But it has... his idea that in order to win the war, they need to put any able-bodied male slaves into the army and basically say, you will be emancipated. You will be freed if you do this. And part of what Claiborne said in this is, it is said that slavery is all we are fighting for. And if we give it up, we give up all. Even if this were true, which we deny, slavery is not all our enemies are fighting for. It is merely the pretense to establish sectional superiority and a more centralized form of government and to deprive us of our rights and liberties. So he's basically saying, we need to have our independence above all else, and we need to get rid of slavery in order to gain our independence and gain men to fight in the army.
Right. It was pure numbers on a standpoint, yep. And it was a pretty pragmatic one. Claiborne was not an abolitionist by any stretch of imaginations. He saw this merely as a way to get more soldiers. And like I said, Claiborne is going to discuss this plan with his peers, and it's going to go over about as well as suggesting David Ortiz Day at Yankee Stadium is kind of how it goes. And it doesn't work well because in this Emancipation Proclamation, you read a little bit of it, but it goes on and on. Where Claiborne writes, as between the loss of independence and the loss of slavery, we assume that every patriot will freely give up the latter, give up the Negro slave rather than be a slave himself. And he continues hinting that this might help with European intervention they were kind of talking with. He writes, our country already has some friends in England and France, and they are strong motives to induce these nations to recognize and assist us, but they cannot assist us without helping slavery. And to this would be in conflict with their policy for the last quarter century. So this is what he's suggesting. And again, this comes up later on the next year in 1865 in some aspect, but it's too late at that point.
It's not his idea. His thing that he did is not known for a long time.
But when you're talking about a hard slave-owning, fun-loving Confederate like Shot Pouch Walker sitting there hearing this.
He's not a happy man.
I mean, you can tell right off the bat he's pissed. Now, they try to squash this, but Walker grabs it. He's going to send it to Richmond and make sure, by the way, the Wild Irishman wrote this. This is Claiborne.
Yeah.
I want his name attached to this. Needless to say, Richmond shot it down hard and fast, and Jefferson Davis ordered Claiborne's idea completely suppressed, right? And the thing, nowhere specifically does it say Claiborne was blackballed within the army for it, but it should be noted that at this moment, he was a superstar in the army. He already had been, but he had been passed over after this four times for corps command. Okay. He'd already been a temporary corps commander. So it's kind of easy to figure out why he didn't rise above his level. Although it's not, they're not going to write this down, but you can read between the lines.
Yeah,
you
can figure it out, what's going on. And, Shot Pouch Walker, he is like sitting there in this meeting and he's like, no, we're not doing this. He's a slave owner. So is his mother. They own quite a few between the two of them. And he's so offended that he says that, it's treason and any officer advocating it should be held fully accountable. William Bate and Patton Anderson are not happy with it either, but Walker is just, he's livid. He's seeing red with it. And anyway, he ends up, so he goes to Claiborne after and he's like, yeah, can I have a copy of that? And Claiborne's like, yeah, of course you can. And Walker's like, oh, this is sedition and I'm sending it to Richmond to make sure they know about it. And Claiborne's like, have at it. I want them to know. I want the higher ups to have this because Johnston had said no. And then Walker goes to Johnston and says, I have a copy. I'm sending it to Richmond. And Johnston is like, no, you're not. And Walker's like, I am. And he does. And as you said, Davis gets it and was like, oh, we can't have this. And it's not discovered for a few years, I think. But Walker is still seething about it afterwards.
Yeah.
He's going to write everyone who attended the meeting demanding to know how they felt about it. And Hardy and Hindman and a few others did favor some aspects of it. But Hindman writes back to Walker, I do not choose to admit any inquisitorial right to you. So basically, dude, F off. I'm not telling you anything. Hindman was not a fan of Walker.
If you have a controversial idea, you say it. You don't write it. That's the problem, right?
Yeah.
But again, this shows the confidence that Claiborne had.
Yeah.
Again, it was. Also during this winter in Dalton, another aspect of Claiborne's life is going to change, right?
Mm-hmm.
His boss and close friend William Hardy is going to find himself a woman named Mary Lewis Foreman and ask Claiborne to be his best man at their wedding in Demopolis, Alabama in January of 1864. And at this wedding, Claiborne, of course, goes. He's going to meet a woman from Mobile, Alabama, named Mary Foreman's maid of honor, named Susan Tarleton, right? And she was the daughter of a prominent cotton trader in Mobile. It may sound cliche, But it sounds like Claiborne, you know, fell in love with First Sight, right? That's kind of what happened.
He admitted that to Nash. He wrote Nash a letter, or he saw Nash afterwards, his former business partner, and said, I've fallen in love at first sight with this woman. She's 24 years old. Claiborne just became instantly enamored with her. And I mean, Claiborne is awkward as hell with women. Like he wrote, there's like examples of his poetry that he wrote some women. It's terrible. Like it's not good poetry. But he was really shy, really awkward around women. But something about Sue kind of just, he was like, I'm going to go for this. And he asks her before he has to go back to the army, he says, he's like, well, will you marry me? And she's like, no, but you can write me if you want, because we haven't known each other for that long.
Pretty bold. I mean, to ask the chick to marry me. It's so funny because, you know, he does, and then he does the whole typical guy thing where, you know, he reaches out to Robert Tarleton, Susan's brother, right? Yeah. And who told other bridesmaid named Sally Lightfoot, poor Sue is like the last rose of summer. She needs you to advise her about General Claiborne. She is in perplexity, and you know you would be much assistance to help her out. And so basically, he's trying to say, hook me up. He's trying to help me up with this.
Yeah.
You know, after the wedding, Claiborne's going to return to camp near Tunnel Hill, Georgia. And but this is what his staff noticed, how different he was.
Oh, yeah. Irving Buck said, there's something going on. Like, he's so different. Well, he's so
light. He was laughing. He was lighthearted. He was singing songs about the carpenters to everybody. He was bitten hard by the love.
Why do birds suddenly appear?
Probably what it was. But you mentioned Irving Buck. I mean, Irving Buck, he writes, rumor has it General Claiborne lost his heart with a young lady in Mobile. He's been in a heavenly mood and talks about another leave already.
So basically he was a grumpy bastard a lot of the time, apparently, after this, because they're like, whoa, he's in a really good mood now.
Oh, he was. But Claiborne gets awarded a 12-day leave in late February, and he raced back to Mobile faster than you with going to the bar at happy hour. What? And he got there, he high-stepped it pretty quickly. And he asked her, you know, again, was looking for an answer, you know, I asked her to marry me. What's the friggin' deal?
She's finally like, okay, fine. No, actually, I think she was really happy. I think she was really in love with him too.
Oh, he was. He wrote about her, after keeping me in cruel suspense for 6 weeks, she has at last consented to be mine, and we are engaged. So in March, when his leave was over, he had to return to the army, and they wrote each other constantly. They totally did. Yeah. I know you were, you know, all the stuff.
Oh, they totally were. And this is also the time. You know, it's winter and it's, you know, not campaign season. It's between that. But so on March 22nd, 1864, which was 160 years ago today, 5 inches of snow had fallen and there was a snowball fight. So it's the anniversary of the snowball fights that happen in the Army of Tennessee during this winter. One soldier said that they were like, you know, just kind of throwing snowballs at each other. They were, you know, cramming snow into each other's mouth and ears. Like, and I mean, keep in mind, these guys might not have seen this much snow before. But what happened is Polk's brigade attacks Govan's brigade, and Claiborne got involved, and he leads the attack on Govan's campsite, and he gets quote unquote captured. And when the fight was over, Claiborne gave all the men a ration of whiskey. And whether this is also that Claiborne is so happy that he finally has Sue Tarleton, you know, or whatever, but he's partaking in this with the common soldiers. He's having a snowball fight with them. And there's going to be two more. There's going to be one on March 23rd, and there's going to be one on the 31st that Johnston organizes. And Hardy gets involved in a few other ones as well. But it's just this kind of, you know, it's like this break in the campaigning, the battles, and these boys are able to kind of be boys again and have fun. And Claiborne is clearly perhaps the happiest he's ever been in his entire life. You know, he's finally found a home, and he's got Sue Tarleton, who is, you know, honestly the love of his life.
Oh, I mean, they're planning a wedding in June of 1864. Yeah. I mean, I don't think Shot Pouch got to save the date. I don't think he got one. You know, realistically speaking,
I don't think he was anybody's favorite.
No, but little did Claiborne know that his former nemesis, William T. Sherman, is going to screw up his wedding plans, right?
Yeah.
And sadly, Claiborne and Sue Tarleton are never going to see each other again.
Nope, they never
spoil the ending here, but that's going to be about it. While Sherman's march delayed the wedding, Sue was distraught. She wrote to that Sarah Lightfoot. She wrote, heard that this next day his corps, Cleveland's corps, was to move across the Chattahoochee River and take position in Sherman's rear. This puts an end to his visit. I don't know how I'm going to get through it. Right. So again, this leads where what's going to be turned into May 27th of 64, which is going to be where Cleburne's going to rush to the Union right, the Confederate right flank of the Battle of Pickett's Mill.
Yeah.
Right. That's where this is going to be in Dallas. And this is where Cleburne's division now, that battle test division, is going to fight. We talked about that against Howard. A month later, June 27th, Cleburne's going to be front and center at the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain. And he's going to stall Sherman's frontal attack again. And once again, Sherman is probably seeing that Hardy flag in his sleep again, because there these guys are again.
Probably never left.
And no. But, despite the efforts to delay Sherman, the Army of Tennessee commander, Joseph E. Johnson, his delaying tactics really only slowed Sherman down. And before long, the Rebs are going to get pushed all the way back to Atlanta. And that, as you know, that's the final straw for Jeff Davis. That's going to be the end of that. And at this point, Davis is going to famously replace Joseph Johnston with the aggressive John Bell Hood, who had the reputation of being a decorated hard fighter. Some people thought he might be a little reckless, but hey, it is what it is. He's a hard fighter. And, one of Cleburne's long-term associates and one of his staffers, a guy named L.H. Mangum, described Cleburne's opinion of Johnston's removal in favor of Hood. And according to Mangum, he writes, Cleburne considered the removal of Joseph E. Johnson and the appointment of General Hood as a great disaster to the Army and Confederacy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, he also noted that Cleburne, too little of the political general about him to conceal his views. Hence, General Hood had no good feeling about Cleburne. Mm-hmm. Now, again, this is hearsay from different people, so take all this stuff with a grain of salt. But this is the stuff that's being said behind back and forth, right?
And it's by people who are close to Cleburne as well. The other thing, too, that happens to Cleburne during the Atlanta campaign, and it's fairly early on, is he learns of the death of his brother, Kit. Kit, also called Christopher, was part of John Hunt Morgan's cavalry, which we also did an episode on. And he's killed in a skirmish at Dublin, Kentucky, on May 10th, 1864, and he's only 23 years old. So Cleburne learns of that. His brother has died in the Civil War, so that had to be devastating news too. When John Bell Hood takes command, I think it is, it's mixed how people feel about it. Johnson was kind of, I think he was, as you say, slowing down the clock kind of thing, but Davis wanted a fighter, and John Bell Hood was obviously the fighter that he wanted.
There's no question. This is not an indictment of any decisions they made, but this is what it was. I mean, now he's in charge on July 22nd. Hood wants to seize the initiative from Sherman. He attacks James McPherson's line, and again, Cleburne gets the call like he always does. He'll hit the Union flank and come close to breaking it, but eventually he's going to fall back. And this again leads to that cat and mouse game between Hood and Sherman, while that grip is tightening around Atlanta, right? And the Rebs desperately want to hold Macon and the Western Railroad line. So in August of 1864, Hardee's going to arrive in Jonesboro, Georgia, about 25 miles south of Atlanta, and attack Union troops looking to cut the railroad tracks there, right? And again, Cleburne is temporarily going to be placed in charge of Hardee's corps at this point. But the attack on August 31st fails, primarily because Stephen D. Lee screws up and attacks too early, and the timing's all screwed. It just was, but... Basically, Cleburne's personally leading this attack. There's a hand-to-hand fighting combat, and eventually he's going to fall back again. But the month of September goes by, and really both armies, they kind of hit a lull going into October. Yep. Hood pulls his Army of Tennessee into northern Georgia to attack Sherman's supply line. He'll then continue northern Alabama, hoping Sherman's kind of going to leave Atlanta and follow him, but Sherman doesn't take the bait.
No, he goes the other way.
He goes, he does his march to the sea, and that goes on. But Hood decides to keep going north, and he's going to try, he wants to seize Nashville. And around this time, Cleburne runs into an old friend of his from the past, Mary. He runs into Dr. Charles Nash, that former pharmacy owner back in Helena, who hired him back in the day when he first moved to Arkansas. In their conversation, Nash asked Cleburne about their chances going forward. And Cleburne, being the historical study, he says, We are going to take the war into Africa, but I fear that we will not be as successful as Scipio was. Referring to the Roman attack on Carthage in 205 AD. Always fun to mention Publius Cornelius Scipio Africanus. So the hell
studied
is,
that
right?
gentleman quite a bit in my classical study days.
but Hood's army is going to it will move north into Tennessee, and their Union commander John Schofield has two Union corps that were detached from Sherman's army. Right, Hood wants to cross the Duck River and cut the Columbia Pike in half near Spring Hill, Tennessee. And Claiborne's men were asked to basically lead the march, to Spring Hill. Now, Schofield saw this, began to head there too. And again, we're not going to go into details of this, but suffice it to say, for whatever happened, somewhere in the Army of Tennessee, there was a miscommunication, right? That led to the halting of the rebel attack when night fell. And when morning came, Schofield's Union men had passed through Spring Hill towards Franklin when the Rebs slept as close as 100 yards away from the turnpike when these troops marched down. And Schofield's going to dig in at Franklin, and Hood's going to pursue them. He'll pursue them really badly, but he wants to bag Schofield before he can get to pass Franklin over the Harpeth River into Nashville, right? The Harpeth, the bridge that went across the Harpeth was down.
Yep.
So they knew that if they can get them, they had them pinned, right? And, you know, there's a lot of he said, she said that goes on between what happened between Spring Hill and Franklin among the Army of Tennessee. But to say the least, that no one really knows 100% certainty of what was said for sure. But that being said, you know, there are accounts of stories told by generals who were at the Battle of Franklin discussing conversations they had personally with Patrick Claiborne, right? And again, this is a tough time because you think you have them beat. Some sort of snafu happens. We're not putting blame on anybody with this, but Schofield gets by. Schofield does a really good thing. He gets by.
He should
get more credit than the Confederate screwing up. Admittedly, he does, but he does get by. But there's a lot of pissed off Confederates about it. Because because he slipped right through the fingers. Major General John C. Brown, reportedly riding with Claiborne, who told him the commanding general, Hood, was endeavoring to place upon him, Claiborne, the responsibility of allowing the enemy to pass our position on the night previous, and my information comes through a reliable channel. Brown wrote, I then asked Claiborne who was responsible for the escape of the enemy, who Claiborne said, of course, the responsibility rests with the commander in chief, as he was upon the field during the afternoon and was fully advised during the night of the movement of the army. Now, again, no one knows what Claiborne was told and by whom, but it's clear that Claiborne was feeling, for whatever reason, that he was being blamed for Schofield's escape. Now, again, this is according to Claiborne. We don't know what Hood said to him. We don't know what other people said.
Yeah.
But it's easy to say at that moment, Claiborne felt that he was being fingered for it.
Yeah. And there was a breakfast that happened. Claiborne was not there. And that's apparently where the blame was kind of laid on him by John Bell Hood. Allegedly. Again, we don't know. None of us were there. John Bell Hood did write in his memoirs, years later after this happened, he said, he, Claiborne, therefore made a sudden and firm resolution to me in all my operations, believing that my movements and manner of handling troops were based upon correct principles. It has been said that he stated upon the morning after the affair of Spring Hill that he would never again allow one of my orders for battle to be disobeyed if he could prevent it. For these reasons, his loss became doubly great to me. The heroic career and death of this distinguished soldier must ever endear the memory of his last words to his commander and should entitle his name to be inscribed in immortal characters in the annals of our history. So that is John Bell Hood telling what seems, you know, this is a completely different Claiborne than we're hearing from the account that you had. And again, this goes back to how difficult it is to figure out this period between Spring Hill and Franklin and what exactly happened. You know, we'll never know. It's somewhere in the middle with this.
Oh, and anybody who claims that this is 100% happened, this is 0% happened, it's just foolish because no one really knows. It's all interpretive.
We'll never know. I have my own opinion. You know, like we all have our own opinions on how it went down, how it happened, and all that. You know, like I'm sure there was a lot of anger that morning, you know, going into Franklin. and what happened at Spring Hill, and there was a lot of miscommunication that happened
there
as
was,
well.
But it happens. It happens in all armies. But upon reaching Franklin, Captain Irving Buck, you mentioned, from Claiborne's staff and probably the closest staff officer who wrote about what they saw in Franklin before the battle, he writes, upon his arrival at Winstead Hill, which is about 3 miles south of Franklin, whilst awaiting the formation of his command, he ascended to the summit, raised his glasses upon a stump, and gazed long at the enemy's entrenchments. Claiborne said they were very formidable. General Daniel Govan, sometimes Groven, you may see him.
Groven,
right? He commanded one of Claiborne's Arkansas brigades. He wrote of Claiborne's concerns about attacking the federal position. Govan wrote, General Claiborne has just returned from a consultation with General Hood and his other generals, all of whom were opposed to attacking the main pike, as the enemy could have been flanked and compelled to abandon his position that was strongly positioned, fortified. General Claiborne seemed to be very well despondent as I'd ever seen him. And as I said before he left, well, General, what does he say?
If we are to die, let us die like men.
Well, he says, first, well, General, there will not be many of us who will get back to Arkansas. Yes. To which Claiborne responded, yes, well, Governor, if we are going to die, let us die like men. So this was kind of a feeling it was kind of the end of the story. They knew how it was going to end. Right?
It was like they resigned themselves.
They resigned to the fact. So on November 30th of 1864 at a boot, 4 p.m., right, the order was given and 15,000 men marched across the open fields towards the federal entrenchments when Union artillery opened up on them, beginning the Battle of Franklin. Right now, the Union infantry, you know, they had their musket fire. They were told to hold it as long as possible. And then when they finally began firing on Claiborne's men. And the story of Patrick Claiborne's death was told again by Captain Irving Buck, right? And he wrote both of his horses, Stonewall and Red Pepper,
yep,
right, had both been injured. So he rode a borrowed horse. And this is what Buck wrote. The general went into battle on a borrowed horse, which was killed under him. One of his couriers, James Brandon of Mississippi, dismounted to give him his horse, which was killed by a cannon shot, and the general was in the act of mounting. Not stopping to get another animal, Claiborne proceeded by foot to lead his men. General Govan, he writes a letter about Claiborne's death as well. He wrote, his courier brought him another horse, and in the act of mounting, it was killed. He then disappeared into the smoke, and that was the last time I saw him alive. I saw him waving his cap and urging his men forward. And when the battle ended, you know, Claiborne was missing.
Yep.
They didn't know what happened. He just disappeared. And it caused, obviously, as you can imagine, it caused concern. Govan wrote about that. He wrote, the terrible report that Claiborne was missing ran through our ranks that whole dreadful night. We almost prayed that he might have been wounded only or been captured, but that was not meant to be. I and two others were the first to discover his dead body at early dawn the next morning. He was about 40 or 50 yards from the works. He lay flat on his back as if asleep, his military cap partly over his eyes. He had on a new gray uniform, the coat of the sack of a blouse pattern. It was unbuttoned and open. He wore a white shirt with blood on the front part of the left side just under the abdomen. This was the only sign of a wound I saw on him, and I believe it was the only one he received. Now, Claiborne's body was obviously touched by someone after he died. Mm-hmm. His shoes were gone. His watch and sword belt were also missing. But he was also laid out ceremoniously by someone who had taken the time to do it. And we've talked about the speculation of what that was. And a lot of people think that it was laid out by a Freemason, by the way he was laid out. But again, it's speculation. There are certain things ways he was laid out definitely led to that. But again, it's all speculation. His body was first buried in Columbia, then sent to Mount Pleasant, Tennessee, before being interred and buried for good back in Helena in 1870, right? And it's you can imagine old Sue Tarleton back home with this, right? Yeah. And she finds out of Claiborne's death 5 days later. You know how she finds out about it?
In the newspapers.
She's working in her garden.
Yep.
And the newspaper boy comes riding by yelling, read all about it. Big news, a big battle in Franklin. General Claiborne is killed. That's how she finds out about it, by the newspaper boy.
Yeah.
Right? The news obviously crushed her, and she realized her wedding day with Patrick would never come. You know, she did move on. She got in 1867. She got married to a Major Hugh Lang Cole, an officer on Braxton Bragstaff, of all people.
Yep.
A year later, she's going to be pregnant with their first child, and she's going to suffer a brain hemorrhage and die on June 30th, 1868. So she's going to die young too. And the thing about Patrick Claiborne, and today he remains probably one of the South's most respected generals, whose battlefield leadership earned him that nickname Stonewall of the West. But like we said at the beginning, Claiborne's history and reputation is certainly the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. But it can't be denied that he fought hard to achieve his goal of Southern independence and gave his life for it. Early in the war, Claiborne is to have said, if this, the Confederacy, that is so dear to my heart, is doomed to fail, I pray heaven may let me fall with it while my face is toward the enemy and my arm battling for that which I know to be right. Mm-hmm. Now, fortunately for Claiborne, that's going to be, he's going to be right about that.
Yeah. And Robert E. Lee said of him, on the field of battle, he shone like a meteor in a clouded sky. So even General Robert E. Lee knows of him. General Hardee said, where his division defended, no odds broke its lines. Where it attacked, no numbers resisted its onslaught, save only once. And there is the grave of Claiborne and his heroic division. John Bell Hood said of him, Claiborne was a man of equally quick perception and a strong character, and was especially in one respect in advance of many of our people. And he is referring to Claiborne's Emancipation, which would have come out years after the Civil War, but Hood was around to know about it, obviously. And then when Claiborne was reinterred in 1870 in Helena, Arkansas, General George Gordon gave a speech there about him, and he said, a truer patriot or knightlier soldier never fought and never died. Valor never lost a braver soldier, or freedom a nobler champion. He was a patriot by instinct and a soldier by nature. He loved his country, its soldiers, its banners, its battle flags, its sovereignty, its independence. For these he fought, for these he fell.
And that's who Patrick Claiborne was. I mean, again, he's a controversial guy. He's a romantic type of people who look back on him. Craig Simon's book, Stonewall of the West, tells the great story with this.
Oh, it's an amazing biography.
It absolutely is. But again, at the end of the day, like any part of history, it's all part of interpretation. There are people who think that his personality, his presence is very overrated, especially at the Battle of Franklin. It's over embellished the way Chamberlain is at Gettysburg, or perhaps. But again, that's why we study history, and that's why you read this stuff. And you can all people are, the history is only as good as the quotes who tell the story. And if you tell the story, which is very clear about Patrick Claiborne, he was extremely respected by his men.
Yep.
He was the men fought hard for him. He expected a lot of his men. His upbringing him gave him a level of honor. His experience in Helena gave him a true home to fight for, and he fought for it. And through fighting for the Confederacy in this case, he was able to live the honorable life that I think he felt that he let his father down when he didn't get into medical school. And I think it was a redemption story for him all along. And I think at the end of the day, he knew he was going to have to go into that Battle of Franklin. He probably wasn't going to come out, but he knew that he was going to get there or die trying. And I think he was probably fine either way.
Yeah. He's a story that, he's born in Ireland, and I know there's, some people that are like, well, where you're born is your home. But he truly found his home in Helena, Arkansas. And that's what he was fighting for, is his home. He didn't really, I don't think he really understood the true causes of the Civil War. And I think he's respected on the Union side too. I know Olive wrote us Howard. This is our second Howard reference. Howard refers to Claiborne in his memoirs as the formidable foe. So somebody that was, it's like if we're going up against him, he's a good fighter. And, unlike Chamberlain at Gettysburg, Claiborne does not get to write his story after the war. He doesn't get to tell it. And that's why, these quotes we have from, something like Spring Hill and Franklin are afterwards. And Claiborne can't step in and say, no, this is how it happened. So somewhere in between all those quotes, that we have about how things went down is the truth. And we'll never know 100% what happened at that point in history.
It doesn't. So I think that's a good place to drop this off right here. I think it's a story that's well told. I think it's he's a fascinating guy. And he's someone who I think, no matter what side of the army you're on, you're ever going to appreciate a redemption story. But I think he's somebody who, I think somebody who I think if he looked back, I think he felt that he did the Claiborne name proud, and I think that was a big part of his situation. So what's coming up for us next?
So next, we are going to have our first book club of 2024 on April 16th. We are going to be joined by Ed Lowe to talk about his new book, A Fine Opportunity Lost, which is about James Longstreet's East Tennessee campaign. So that's going to be 7 o'clock Eastern via Zoom, civilwarbreakfastclub@gmail.com. We will send you an invite to that. We're going to be having our next roundtable again soon as well, and hopefully announcing more of our book clubs as well. But we have our first one, A Fine Opportunity Lost, which is about Longstreet by Ed Lowe, Colonel Ed Lowe.
All right. So why don't we jump off? It's a long episode, but I think it's a good episode to do. So any final words from you, Fincheroo?
No, thanks for bringing it like you always do. And we're on to the next one. And thanks to all our listeners.
So if hope your basketball team is doing well, hope your hockey team is doing well, unless you root for Boston University, then the hell with that. But otherwise, off we go. Live is going to be tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning. Hope you can join us. A lot of fun stuff coming up for us down the road. So off we go. Mary, again, the pleasure, as always, was always yours, as you know. And everyone, we appreciate you listening. Have a great Friday night. We'll see you all on the other side.
See y'all later.
Peace out.
Bye.